Welcome to the Animal Control Report with your hosts. Oh, wait, she's not here today. Daniel Ettinger, Ashley Bishop has the day off, but I'm here with Dr. G from the Animal Welfare Junction podcast. So if you don't know about the Animal Welfare Junction podcast, you want to check that out. Dr. G, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for being part of our, I did this last week, podcast network, the Keep It Humane podcast. Keep It Humane Podcast Network. You can find Dr. G's podcast and a few other of our partners there as well. So check that out at www.keepithumane.com/podcast network. Also, check out our Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok pages. Like, share, subscribe. Do all that good stuff that you're supposed to do, because that's what social media is all about, is sharing, getting the word out, etc. And really quick, just a quick ad from our sponsors. Tomahawk Live Trap exceeds customers' expectations by providing them with the highest quality humane animal control products available. Check out their new Pro Series Gravity Door Trap. They feature a door that sets automatically when you open it. So no more messing with the hook or the plate trying to get it to stay open. Just open up that front door and it'll stay until the animal touches the trigger plate. So check it out. It's really cool stuff. Use discount code KEEPITHUMANE for 10% off your order. Again, Keep It Humane for 10% off your order. Cats.
You know, they leave me, they don't care about me. And then as soon as I sit in front of the computer, it's like, what's up? Like, we're awake now. This is our time. This is when we need you.
I think it's great. So I don't think anybody would complain about having the cats here on the Animal Control Report. So, and then check out your podcast is available everywhere as well. You're doing it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere else people can go to listen to it.
Yep, everywhere that anybody gets. And again, they can get directly, if you know, people that don't have a preferred podcast network, they can go to the Humane page and to the podcast network page and click on it from there.
Yeah, and that'll take you right there to Dr. G's podcast. How long have you been doing Animal Welfare Junction now?
So it was a year on January 14th. That's awesome. Just a year. Yeah. Yeah. And it's been pretty cool. You know, I hope that people would like the information. I hope that people would listen. And I did not expect the amount of downloads and the feedback that I've gotten. So I'm really pumped up about it.
Well, you know what they say, if you build it, they will come. So
that's right.
Yeah. So you got that going for you.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's a great, great show. So check it out, please. Like, if you have time to throw it into your queue, just add it there and you'll hear some great stuff. So I was actually listening to the one with Dr. Kevin Hurst. He is definitely not a doctor.
Dr. Kevin Hurst.
That's not him. he was on there talking about sexual assault on animals and some other stuff. And that's always a tough subject to talk about. So, you know, those are good things. We've had a few people on before to talk about that stuff. And there's a lot that goes into those cases. One thing that was really interesting that stood out to me in your episode with him was the fact that, and I've talked about this before, veterinarians aren't really trained on what to look for if an animal comes in that has been sexually abused. And we'll go down that route here in a second about your path into becoming a veterinarian and what that looks like. But yeah, the forensics of it all, or the trauma of it all, how to identify that? That's not something that's taught in vet school, is it?
No, and nowadays there are some electives that some students can take, and some schools are trying to build a little bit into their core curriculum, at least in the shelter medicine side of it. But we have a really long way to go before veterinarians are properly trained in how to deal with cruelty situations.
One thing I find interesting too, in regards to that, is there are some states that won't release documents. So let's say animal control or law enforcement's like, hey, I need your patient's documents. Some states still have this like idea of it being the HIPAA law, where it's not the HIPAA law.
Yeah.
And so check your state statute. I know for Colorado, there's one specific to veterinarians have to release any information that is requested during an investigation. And then here in California, we have a similar one that talks about the veterinarians releasing it, and it doesn't, you know, get involved with their client patient privileges. It's just required by law. So
Yeah, and that's how it is here in Ohio. We have a mandatory reporting law, and it's a really extensive mandatory reporting because it's not just veterinarians have to report on suspected animal cruelty and even suspected human issues, human violence. Like if a client comes in and we're concerned that it's a domestic violence situation, we are mandated to report on that. But then other professionals are supposed to report as well. So if a social worker is in a home and they see animal abuse, they also have to report on that animal abuse. So it's a really neat, very I don't know, very necessary cross-reporting law. But again, if we don't train people to recognize the signs, then it's kind of not gonna be worth it.
And so what, I don't know if I want to, yeah, I'll just ask now. We can talk about it more when we go into just the route of becoming a veterinarian, but is there like a couple of days worth of recognizing domestic violence as a veterinarian? Do they teach that, or is it just more common sense?
No, it has to be more common sense. Like, I mean, realistically, there's not a lot of training on it, right? So and here in Ohio, the Ohio Veterinary Medical Association released a pamphlet, like a catalog on how to address cases of suspected cruelty and neglect. And even though it's re relatively full of information, it's still lacking some of the details. Even for example, like the sexual assault, identifying sexual assault in an animal, it just says finding signs of sexual assault. Like it doesn't even go into the details, right? So it's not, it's, we still, I mean, again, we just have a long way to go for that.
We do. And one study that I'm actually working on and I'm getting ready to put out a training is the link between domestic violence and abuse and dog bites. Yeah, because there's a lot that's not talked about when it comes to dog bites. But there is a big correlation to the trauma that dogs experience and how that changes their behavior patterns, lowers their bite inhibition, etc. So, all right, well, let's jump in. I kind of wanted to have a conversation with you today about the processes of becoming a veterinarian. You know, in this, we're seeing in this country that there is a shortage of veterinarians. Like, we know that that's not just veterinarians, but vet techs, etc. And then we have, you know, our shortage of all general veterinarians. We have shortage at for shelter vets, livestock vets, large animals, equine, etc. And so I just want to understand, like, maybe someone's listening that's like, you know, that's a possible career approach for me. Like, what's the first thing you recall, like, when you decided, all right, I'm going to go to vet school? Like, how did you just like decide on the school you went to? Like, what was the process?
So, very few people can say that they've known what they want to do since they were little.
Yeah.
I was 5 years old and I was being interviewed for some newspaper thing, and they asked me what I wanted to do, and I said I wanted to be a vet. So, I have no family members that are veterinarians, no family members that are animal, I don't know, into animal welfare or animal activists or anything like that. So, for whatever reason, since I was about 5 years old, I said, I'm going to be a vet. And that's the path that I took. The biggest thing that I would say helped me was when I was in high school, I started working at a veterinary clinic as an assistant. And that is extremely important. So anybody listening that is interested in any career in veterinary medicine, they have to do that. You got to find a place, you got to find a clinic to go work, or a shelter that has a veterinarian, because you don't know what you don't know, right? So you have to go and see the good and the bad. A lot of people think, especially younger kids, think, yeah, it's kind of cool. I'm going to play with puppies and kittens all day. And you don't play with puppies and kittens all day. You play with puppy and kitten poop all day, but you're not really playing with animals. And you're dealing with healthy animals. You do wellness stuff, but then we also have to be prepared to deal with the sick animals, the injured animals, the abused animals. So when I was in high school, again, I started working at this veterinary clinic, and that just cemented for me that that's what I wanted to do, that that's what I was meant to do. In looking for veterinary schools, I went to vet school back in 1995. So even looking at undergrad, I wanted to go to an undergrad that had a vet school. So I went to Michigan State University. They at that time, they're I feel old. Their vet school was a very new building. And now it's like 30 years old. So yeah, so I'm old, but that's okay. But so yeah, so I went there for undergrad, and then I went to Ohio State for vet school. The way that I made my decisions, I mean, realistically, to go to Ohio State, I applied to, I want to say, six or seven different places, and for different reasons, I didn't get accepted in other places, and I got accepted to Ohio State. So, you know, finding what school you want to go to has to deal with it to some people with geography, family, and that kind of stuff. But in the end, as long as it's an accredited veterinary school, then you're on the right path. And at that point, it's completely up to you because you have to put forth effort, right? School's going to teach you, school's going to give you information, but you gotta put the effort to move forward.
When you talk about just your underground at Michigan State, you said, or University,
Yes.
Michigan State.
Michigan State University, yeah.
So, what was your undergrad in?
So my undergrad, the first 2 years were undecided, like pre-vet, and
Okay.
they only let you get away with being pre-vet for about 2 years. I sneaked in and was pre-vet for 3 years, and then they caught
Okay.
me. So my last year, I had to declare a major, and then I actually declare a major in zoology. And the main reason for it, I mean, realistically, schools want to graduate people, right? They get stats for graduating students. So I had the majority of credits that I needed to graduate in zoology. It made sense with what I was doing. So I did obtain a bachelor's in zoology from Michigan State. To go to vet school, the degree is not as important as just having the prerequisites and having good grades on those prerequisites.
So we're talking about like you had to do like general math classes, general like history classes in college to get the credits. And then from there, once you're at you after 4 years, right? So you get is it your major in whatever, zoology, right? And then from there you go and do you apply for vet school or is it something that you've done already? Like how does that process work?
Yeah, so most people are going to do a 4-year undergrad. Some people can try to cram it all in 3 years, and some people take a little bit longer. Every vet school has different requirements. So you have to see, all the different vet schools that you want to apply to. You want to download or find out what their class requirements, what their credit hour requirements, because they're going to have different requirements for what math classes they require,
Got it.
how many biologies, how many physics, how much social studies. Like, for instance, I wasn't able to apply to Florida, or I applied to Florida, but they didn't decline my application because I was 1 credit short in social studies. So, you have to make sure that you have your requirements complete before being able to, apply. And then now most schools are steering away from the GRE, but there are some schools that still require it. So again, it's just knowing what you have to do from day one, not waiting until you're in senior and then trying to figure out what do I want to do to get into vet school.
I mean, it sounds like a great path. Like there's a lot of commitment to it. There's a lot of probably workshops, studying, understanding like the dynamics of mathematics, because I would imagine there's a lot of measurements, right? And like understanding weight and how many y'all talk crazy about, I don't like a meg. I don't know what a freaking meg is. Like I need 10 megs of this. Can you say cc's please? Because I don't know what a meg is. It's probably the same thing, right? Like what is a meg?
Well, a mil is a cc, a meg is just going to be like a quantity of more like solids, like tablets and that kind of stuff, tablets and capsules.
Okay.
And even actually, I shouldn't say that, it's going to be more like the concentration that it is in whatever medication.
Got it. Okay. So now we get into grade or grad school. We're doing our doctorate degree in veterinary medicine. Is it boring?
It is not boring. Now, you got to remember that I went to school like 25 years ago, right? So it has changed a lot from when I went to school to what's happening now.
Okay.
Back when I was growing up, and I would tell people, I'm going to be a vet, they were always like, oh my God, that's so hard. And you go to school forever. And when you graduate, you just don't have a life. So then I grew up thinking, okay, this is the career that I have chosen, and this is what's going to take to do it. And I was prepared, right? So I went to school knowing I'm going to have no time for anything, and I'm going to have to bust my butt just studying all the time. And when I got to school, I found out that it wasn't that bad. So it was very challenging. But I had time for other stuff. I actually, sometime in my first year of vet school, I started a karate school and I got my black belt degree by the time I would graduated. So I had time for myself. I had time to do stuff. But it was very challenging, you know, and the way that things were when I went to Ohio State back in 1995, it was how do you say it was very systems oriented. So I started vet school and it was like, okay, the nervous system and the endocrine system and that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Now vet school is switching to more of they're trying to do more of a practical approach
See,
to veterinary
that's
medicine.
exactly why I asked. Because I feel like the
Yeah.
first couple of years, you're like just sitting in a, assembly room talking about like thoracic whatever,
Right.
or toxoplasmosis instead of like getting into a clinic and doing actual vet work.
Yeah, like all the animals that you see are the animals from the anatomy lab, right? So you have diseased animals in formaldehyde that you're just trying to do dissections on in your anatomy lab. So nowadays, the anatomy stuff still exists, but they're approaching things kind of like the healthy. Like Ohio State has like the healthy nervous system or the healthy head or something like that, and they evaluate all the parts of a healthy individual, and then they just keep going through that, and then after that they start teaching them about disease processes. So it's a lot different, and there are some things that I really like about it compared to when I went to school, but I also feel that when I went to school because everything was so kind of like intense. They fed us a lot more information than what they're getting right now.
Do you have like a certain moment, an impact moment in that, like when you were in the doctor degree part, like going to get that, was there like an impact moment? Like, yes, like this is clicking and I'm going to be handling it. Like this is my next profession.
Yeah, so again, this is what I wanted to do forever. So once I got into vet school, I was super pumped up. What I was gonna say, like when I went to vet school, I knew that that's where I wanted to be. So I was just so pumped up to be there, and I was just absorbing as much information as I could. Now again, because I had worked at a veterinary clinic, I already had basic understanding of what was happening, so it was easier to learn things because I could relate to what I was learning. But as far as an impact moment, I knew that I wanted to do small animal more so than large animal because I was not comfortable with large animal stuff. And I've always liked surgery. But when I was in my senior rotations, I had some amazing surgeons as the clinicians when I was in the endosurgery rotations. And that is what really led me to be so involved with surgery. I didn't think when I graduated, I thought I was just going to graduate and possibly go back to Puerto Rico or something and then just, you know, work at a regular clinic, do like general practice and that kind of stuff. And one of my instructors, Dr. Steve Schrader, he's an orthopedic surgeon. He's now retired and he does actually a lot of shelter work now during his retirement because veterinarians don't know how to retire. But I was helping with a procedure and he said, you have a good knack for this. You should do an internship and you should look into a residency. And those words were all it took, right? For me to be like, I could do more than what I think. So I did pursue an internship. I went to University of Missouri and did an internship in small animal medicine, surgery, and critical care. And the goal was to do a residency. And doing residency, especially back then, it was super competitive. And you had to kiss a lot of ass to get good references and that kind of stuff. And I'm just not a really good ass kisser. So I decided during my internship, I'm not gonna pursue a residency. I'm just gonna go to practice. And another one of my surgery professors, Dr. Steve Burchard, he's a soft tissue surgeon. I told him I want to be a surgeon, but I don't know, you know, that I wanna go through the residency and that kind of stuff. And he said to me, you don't have to do a residency to be a surgeon. You know, you just gotta learn and apply and just do what you do. So that was my second push to, again, doing what I do.
I want to back up a little bit though to like having being in school, being in college for 8 years. Like, what is that like? You didn't take a break, right? Like, you went through the whole way.
Right. So one thing is I graduated high school when I was 16. So 8 years for me was not like 8 years for other people. So I graduated when I was 24, whereas most people I
Oh,
graduated
wow.
at school are about 26. But no, to me, school was kind of like going to work. It's like the next thing. So it wasn't a burden. Like, oh my God, I have 3 more years of school.
You didn't think
Like
about
I
that.
love learning. Right, I'm 48 years old. I'm still in school. Like I'm doing a
Well, and
master's.
yeah, we'll get to that here in a second. But like in the vet school program, like how many days when you were doing it, and like you said, it's different now, it's more practical in some aspects, but how many days would you be in the lab versus doing academic work in the room?
So during the first 3 years, most of the schoolwork was like Monday through Friday. And it was, just again like classwork type stuff. And then we would
Sure.
have some labs and we would have some other stuff. But most of it realistically was Monday through Friday. There might be some labs on weekends. People would get into study groups. Once we got into senior year, which senior year, the senior rotations don't start like in the fall. They start in the spring of your junior year. So it lasts a little bit longer. And then once you're on that, it just depends on what rotation you are. So there are some rotations that you work through the weekend, like emergency rotations and such. And there are other rotations that are more like Monday through Friday type rotations.
Okay. Well, I think like so towards the end of your, I guess, final semester, you're doing, are you, when do you do your externships? Is it pre-graduation?
So externships per se, most when I went to school, we had to do 4 weeks of externship
Okay.
minimum. So you could do up to 10 weeks, but you had to do four. Now there are different requirements. I want to say they have to do three or four separate rotations, and each one is 2 weeks long. So those happen during the senior year. So the idea is you are in that kind of like doctor training. So the first few years, you're doing a lot of learning what's normal, learning what's abnormal. But then that last year is when you actually get to, kind of like play doctor for a year, being supervised by real doctors.
Almost, so basically a residency in some aspects.
Yeah, but it depends on where you go, how much they allow you to do. So
Okay.
there are some kids that will go to do an externship at like a referral practice, and most of what they're doing is observing. And they will be part of rounds, and the clinicians will ask them stuff, but most of what they're doing is observing. We do externships. We have spay neuter externships for veterinary students. And from the first day that they come to us, they are doing surgeries. And they're monitored, and it's a very gradual I say going from cat neuters, which are the simplest procedures, to dog spays, which are the hardest. We take them through it so that they're the best that they can be at one procedure before they move to the next one. So it's 2 weeks that they get to do probably about 80, 100 surgeries, depending on the student. So there's a lot of difference depending on the type of experience they're getting and where they're getting it at. And it makes sense, right? So with us, they're learning to do spays and neuters, which are considered, I don't want to say simple because they're not easy, but they're, as far as surgeries are concerned, they're considered relatively, well, they're considered elective. But if you want to be a neurologist and you go do an externship with a brain surgeon, it's not like they're going to be like, okay, come here and
Yeah.
let's, dink into this brain. Like that's not going to happen. So it just kind of depends on the experience.
I want to come back to that process of spay and neuter, but before we do, let's talk about, so you're currently in school for a forensic degree, right?
I'm currently in school for a Master's of Study in Law at
Okay.
Lewis and Clark University, College of Law. So
Okay.
it's a master's in animal law. So I just finished in December, I finished a master's in forensic science
That's what, okay.
through the University of Florida.
Okay.
Before that, I did a forensic psychology through Southern New Hampshire University. And before that, I did a master's in for veterinary forensics also through University of Florida. So I'm hoping
So,
that this is going to be the last one.
I mean, well, because you're probably in mega debt with all these degrees, like seven masters, two doctorates, four forensics. In all seriousness, though, do you think that you'll ever stop going to school?
I think this animal law degree, because I mean, every time that I take a degree, I'm like, okay, this is it. This is the last one. And then something else happens. But this animal law degree really helps wrap up everything that I feel I need to be a better advocate in animal cruelty and neglect cases.
Okay.
So I think that from here, it may be more taking classes like more like continuing education or I don't know, that kind of stuff, seminars, going to conferences, more
Sure.
so than actually classes that I have to, you know, do quizzes and take tests and write papers and that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Do you do necropsies? Are you a forensic necropsy professional?
Yeah, so I do necropsies. I'm not a pathologist, so
Okay.
there's a little bit of a difference, right? Like they're similar to human medicine, veterinarians can specialize, and one specialty is pathology. And within pathology, even there's gross pathology, which is actually doing the necropsies, and then there are people that are pathologists that look at slides and, you know, determine the molecule, not the molecules, but the cells and stuff that are happening like at a cellular level of the tissues. So I do necropsies as a forensic veterinarian. And I am able to do the exams, collect samples. If I collect samples, then I can send them out to a pathologist and try to determine the cause why an animal died. You know, if it's something that I can figure out.
Okay. Now, going back to probably one of the most common things, and one of the things that we as a profession need help with the most. And when I say profession, animal welfare, like the animal shelter world, you know, access to care, like providing access to care for animals in need. Spaying and neutering. Like, you and I have talked about it offline. I've brought up the fact that, like, why not have just spay and neuter technicians versus actual doctors? And I think at some point, maybe that happens, but I know there's some pushback on that because, you know, an anesthetized animal could create, there could be an emergency, and not having an actual veterinarian on hand could make things pretty severe if something like that were to happen. So then I envision, like, what if you have one veterinarian on staff, and then you have 10 veterinary assistants, or however you want to define them, that can perform the spay and neuter process? Because, like, walk me through it. That's what I'd like to know. And I think spays are a little bit more difficult surgery than neuter, but let's just, like, from waking up in the morning, you know it's a surgery day. What does that look like?
So at my facility, I'm blessed with the fact that I have four registered technicians that are amazing at what they do. So they can help me do what I need to get done throughout the day. And then I have two assistants that are really, really good at what they do. Like the biggest difference between them is that, you know, the four are registered and the other two are assistants. So there's differences in what they are allowed to do legally.
Okay.
But as far as knowledge, they're all very knowledgeable. So my schedule is normally between 30 and 50 surgeries per day. And it depends if it's going to be dogs, cats, like what the combination of things are going to be. It's not like I graduated from vet school and I was able to do 50 surgeries, right? It takes time, it takes training, it takes practice. Vet school doesn't really prepare you extremely well to do spays and neuters. And it depends on the student. There are students that will go out and seek opportunities to learn, and there are students that just do kind of like the bare minimum what school allows. So I know veterinarians from different schools, not Ohio State, from other places that graduate and they have only done like one spay, and that doesn't really prepare anybody to do anything. Other schools may, you know, they may get to do about 5 or 10. It's just a repetition, the doing it, the feeling comfortable with every aspect of the surgery that allows me to be able to get these surgeries done at an efficient pace, but also a safe pace for my patients.
So talk to the listeners about, okay, you have a neuter on, like, that's on the table. Step by step, what happens?
Yeah, so I mean, when let's back it up a little bit. Even when patients come into our unit, they get sedated. The dogs get sedated. The cats get placed into cages, and then when the cats are ready to have surgery, then they get an injection that is kind of like sedation and a little bit of anesthesia all at once. So that way, like the cat neuters do not need to be under anesthesia for very long. So sometimes that medication is sufficient. Sometimes we need to put them on gas. The dogs, all the dogs, and then the cat space get intubated so they can maintain on oxygen and gas anesthesia for their safety. As far as a cat neuter, which is going to be the simplest procedure, literally it takes me about 25 to 35 seconds to neuter a cat.
How long?
So it is about 25 to 35 seconds
What? Once you
to
from
neuter a cat.
cutting to cut in and to all
Yeah,
that stuff.
because you don't have to place stitches. So it's making an incision, retrieving the testicle, ligating the cord, rinse and repeat to the other side, and it's done. So
Wow.
the procedure is very, very quick. You get into a dog neuter, for me on average, is about 3 to 5 minutes for the surgery.
Okay.
It's more because in dogs it's bigger. They do require for them to be sutured up. So they have an incision made right above their scrotum, right above where the testicles are. The testicles are completely removed, so it's not like a vasectomy. We're actually removing the testicles, ligating, and then closing everything up. And some people ask about, well, especially like macho dudes are like, well, I want my dog to keep its balls because, he's a man. Well, first, your dog's not a man. Your dog's a dog. Second, it doesn't need its balls to assert its masculinity. Like, the dog doesn't care. But removing the testicles is actually important because it decreases testosterone, which can be associated with aggression and behavior
Sure.
problems like roaming and urinations. But also the older a dog is that has testicles, the prostate continues to enlarge. Now, I want people to understand removing the testicles does not prevent prostate cancer, but it prevents prostate enlargement, which by itself can cause a lot of problems. And then there are testicular tumors and things like that that can happen. So there are a lot of benefits in neutering dogs. We get into cats. The average cat spay is going to take me about 6 to 8 minutes. Actually, I should say 5 to 6 minutes. It's more invasive because we are going inside of the abdominal cavity. So we're making an incision into the abdomen, we're retrieving the ovaries, we're retrieving the uterus, and then closing everything up. And then finally, the dog spays are going to be the ones that are about 8 minutes, 8 to 10 minutes. And they're more difficult just because there's more bleeding, there's more tissues, like there's more vessels compared to a cat. So, and that tends to be a lot more fatty tissue. So they're a little bit more difficult. So because of the increasing level of difficulty from one procedure to another, that's what how we manage our mentorship programs or our externships is that they start with that cat neuter until I tell them until their fingers hurt, right? Until they've done so many that they can close their eyes and get it done. And then they move to the dog neuter. And they're using skills that they learn with the cat neuter to do the dog neuter. And then the skills that they learn with that one, they use for the cat spay, and then those skills they use for the dog spay. So, teaching students to be good, to be efficient, and move them at a good pace so that they feel really, really confident with what they're doing.
That's really cool stuff. And I think from the aspects of just understanding, if you ever get a chance to do like a, like, I wouldn't call it a ride along, but like a lab day with your veterinary clinic, I highly recommend it. I think that stuff's super fascinating. And honestly, that's what's going to lead us into like the success of this profession of not having overpopulation is finding access to care, finding ways to really take these large scale spay and neuter clinics and make them readily available in communities that don't even have access to care, like they're in a veterinary desert, right? And so coming in there in a mobile, like however you think about it, and being able to like knock out 30 in a day or 60 in a day, stay there for a few weeks, right? And bust out a couple hundred, like that's going to be impactful for our community. So we have to continue to approach that in that way.
Yeah.
Sorry
Well,
for the
and you mentioned as far, no, you're fine. I was going to say, like, you mentioned as far as like with tech, should technicians be doing these surgeries and that kind of stuff? And I mean, I look at my technicians and I think that they have amazing skills, wicked skills. So they're not allowed to do surgeries, but they're allowed to do things like close incisions, do skin sutures, that lacerations and that kind of stuff. So I know that my technicians have great skills and I know that they're very intelligent people. So I would love for them to be allowed to do spays and neuters. And I don't think that they should be able to do it on their own. Like, I'm just going to stay home and then they can just
Yeah,
take
no,
the
but you're
truck
in the
out,
building.
right? Exactly. If I am there to be able to take care of any kind of problem, even if they're only able to do neuters, for instance, that's fine. They can do all the neuters, I can do all the spays. Like this shortage of veterinarians that we have trained professionals that go through school. It's not like techs just, somebody gives them a certificate or they just apply for something. No, they go through school for anywhere between 2 and 4 years, depending on what they're doing, and they have to do CE. They have to do the same stuff that we do. So yeah, I'm a big proponent for technicians being able to be utilized better.
I think we just have to continue that narrative. I know California just passed the law now saying that a veterinarian doesn't have to be present to administer vaccinations. So, like most states require a veterinarian to be on site when you're doing a rabies vax. And I'm pretty sure that that has gone away here in California. So, just something like that. I think there's a lot of opportunity for continued growth. And I think what happens is we as a culture or we as a human beings, if you will, like we get comfortable with what things are or how things are. It's like this is the norm. This is the way that things are supposed to be. And not and and then we don't challenge the next set. Like we're just like, okay, this is cool. But here's the reality. And something that I've talked about forever on this episode is like we can't keep doing the same thing and expecting different results. And that's what we're doing is we're relying on foster programs, rescues, we're relying on, having these live release rates, which it doesn't do anything. Like, and I shouldn't say that. I mean, I'm sure there's some like benefit of having animals not be euthanized, but at the same time, it's like if we can limit the amount of animals that are coming into the shelter, then that whole live release rate becomes moot because there's not any animals coming into the shelter. Or we focus our efforts overseas and we start importing animals here. We already do that. There's groups that go down to Mexico and bring dogs up all the time, right? Especially here in a border town where I'm at. So, like, I know that exists. And I want people to understand that, like, we have to continue to fight the fight for us to have more availability to give animals these, the spay and neuters. And I know years ago, maybe it was like 4 years ago, somebody was working on a injection for male dogs to make them sterile. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, Nutrisol, the first time that I heard about it was, shoot, like 13, 14 years ago. And it's basically an injection that's given directly into the testicles and it just atrophies the testicles.
Okay.
And it sounded like a great idea. But then the whole thing about it was the whole push for it was you don't have to do surgery and you don't need anesthesia. They were trying to somewhat blow up the potential risks with surgery to try to say this product is better. And I think it's a really good product, but the problem is that okay, you don't need anesthesia, but tell me who wants to get an injection into each nut? Nobody,
Yeah, I'll
right?
pass. I'll pass on
So
that.
the right. And it stings and it burns and it can cause problems, injection site issues, infections and that kind of stuff. So I think that that's the main reason why it didn't really
Take off.
have a good success. Yeah. And they had it just kind of disappeared. Now, the other problem is that it shrank the testicles, but it didn't make them go away. So then if you as a shelter get one of these dogs that has had this injection,
You wouldn't
you're
know.
gonna say, right, you're gonna say, oh, his testicles are really small, but they're still there. So the dog's still gonna have surgery. So there are groups that have been working towards different modes of injectable and chemical sterilization. That sounds very promising. So I am hopeful that something will happen just to assist. We're way behind in spays and neuters, and not and I'm saying we. I'm not mean my clinic, which my clinic is way behind, but just as a nation, we're way behind in spays and neuters, and a lot of people blame it on COVID and all that stuff, but this was coming. This has been going on for a really long time.
It has nothing to do
So
with
we
COVID.
need, right? No, yeah. It's just that as things started getting bad, COVID happened, and then it gave people a reason, like an excuse. But no, this has been going on. And again, as I mentioned, veterinarians do not graduate just being really efficient in spay neuter. And there's not a lot of people that are good at mentoring and teaching. So these veterinarians graduate, and even if they're interested in sterilizing spay and neuter, they have to train. And if there's nowhere for them to train, then we're going to be lacking high volume veterinarians.
And that's like for us as just the general like profession, that's where it starts. We really need to figure out ways. So we need to be supportive however we can. We need to talk to our veterinarians, whether it's at our shelters, figure out ways to, I would say, create like I say this a lot now, is like create scholarships for our next generation veterinarians. Some of these big organizations that have that ability to do so, I think would be really important because at the end of the day, I hear it from a lot of vets. They're either like, hey, there's no one to like, they're like large scale livestock or equine, and they're like, there's no one behind me. Like once I retire, that's it. Like this town is
Right.
not gonna have large animal veterinary work help, and that's rough. So, I appreciate you giving insight for our listeners and those that are watching on Spotify or YouTube because you can watch this episode as well. I apologize for rubbing my knee the whole time, but speaking of surgery, as you know, most people know I've had that just recently, and this shit hurts. Not to say that much.
Yeah.
This shit hurts.
Yeah.
So So that's good stuff. Was there anything that we didn't get to that you want to make sure our listeners know
I
before we
mean,
wrap up?
just I would say, like you said, supporting veterinarians and that kind of stuff, there's a lot of compassion fatigue happening, and a lot of it is happening because there's I don't know, some people expect too much, some people as far as clients, and then there are kids going into vet school that don't expect what's going to happen, and then they graduate, and again it's like, oh, this is not what I thought it was going to be, and I only want to work 2 days a week, and I want to do this because I want to have good balance, the work-life balance. I'm all for work-life balance. I'm horrible at work-life balance personally, but work-life balance is work-life balance. It's not a little bit of work on everything, everything else. So, just clients need to be understanding. People like rescues and stuff need to be understanding, and they need to work closely with the veterinarians to make this profession worthwhile to a lot of people. And then people that want to be into this profession, just make sure this is what you want to go before you go down this whole expenses and time and everything else. I know a few people that first or second year of vet school, they decided this is not what they wanted to do, but they were already invested, so they finished it up and they're miserable veterinarians now, right?
Wow.
So just know what you're getting into. Have your heart and mind set, and I would not change it for the world. I would not go back in time and become something different. I can do so many different things. I have so many opportunities. Sky's the limit. So I, you know, if you're up for it, I highly recommend it.
That's great. And I think hopefully we inspired a listener or two today to really look at it. And just some help in the veterinary world will go a long way. And we support it here on the Animal Control Report. I know you support it on the Animal Welfare Junction. Again, check out the Animal Welfare Junction wherever you download and listen to podcasts. You can like, share, rate that podcast as well. T check out Dr. G on LinkedIn or so any social media aspects, and check us out as well. We'll be back next week with our regular team. Bishop is back, and we have a friend of the show coming and joining us from Missouri. So that'll be fun. Looking forward to that. Well,
Excellent.
thank you, Dr. G, for taking the time tonight to be part of the show. As always, we like to say thanks for listening and help people help animals. That's our new slogan for 2024.
Help people help animals.
Yep.
Fantastic. Love it.
And keep it humane.